In the coming week, U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin is slated to travel to Israel. Talks on reviving the Iran nuclear deal continue in Vienna, and Peru holds a general election amid COVID-19 concerns. It's April 8th, 2021, and time for The World Next Week. I'm Bob McMahon.
And I'm Jim Lindsay. Bob, U.S. Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin is set to travel to Israel this weekend for the first cabinet-level visit to the Middle East by a member of the Biden administration. Secretary Austin is expected to meet with Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu, Defense Minister Benny Gantz, and Foreign Minister Gabi Ashkenazi. What's on Secretary Austin's agenda for these talks?
Jim, it's an interesting and potentially extremely crucial visit or set of visits coming up. And why I say interesting is a bit of scant details coming from the Pentagon and the U.S. in general at this point. Most of the reports that I've seen about the trip have come from Israeli officials. They have not been refuted in any sense or knocked down by the U.S. side. The U.S. side is just not sharing a lot. So that leads to all sorts of speculation about not only the scope of the trip. I think the fact of the trip is probably pretty firm, but the scope of the trip is the other question, whether or not it will include other countries, for example. But in terms of Israel itself, there's plenty for the two sides to discuss. First cabinet level visit, as you say, to Israel from the Biden administration. And he's meeting the top trio of leading security officials in Israel. And they will be talking about a whole host of things and coming at a time when the region's in a bit of ferment. You can say that almost any time about the Middle East, but certainly in the moment, you have Netanyahu working yet again to try to pull together a coalition government. You have neighboring Jordan dealing with an unusual bit of what officials call sedition involving members of the royal family that also led to a President Biden phone call with the King of Jordan to offer support. You have U.S. discussions going on with Iraqi officials about phasing a U.S. drawdown in Iraq that has drawn a lot of attention in recent days. And you, as always, have lots of developments involving Iran. We'll get to some of those in more detail a little bit later. But most recently, Israeli-Iranian incidents involving shipping in the region, especially in the Red Sea, reports of an Israeli attack on an Iranian ship, for example, or Israeli mining of an Iranian ship. Those followed reports of Iranian actions against Israeli ships. And so no shortage of things to talk about. Obviously, Syria, Lebanon is also supposed to be on the agenda, according to Israeli officials. And I think it's a big thing here is just sort of follow through on what had been an extremely robust relationship that the Trump administration had forged with the Israeli government, and a sense for the Israelis to gauge how the Biden administration is planning to proceed with everything from the Abraham Accords to continuing to forge ahead on agreements involving Iran and the Iran nuclear deal, which I think we'll get to in a little bit.
Bob, can we talk a little bit about the state of Israeli politics? You have the Secretary of Defense going to Israel. The Israelis have just come out of an election that looks like it is the fourth relatively indecisive election. Prime Minister Netanyahu has been tasked with forming a government. It's not clear that he can do so. What can the Israeli government do now that it's in this sort of post-election pre-government formation phase?
I think if this had been the first time they were in this phase, there would be a lot of questions about that and a lot of concerns about the viability of any sort of actions or promises by the Israeli government. But this is becoming, as we've talked about previously in the podcast, this is becoming a kind of a serial condition for Israeli politics. And Netanyahu certainly himself is used to, I think, more and more used to governing or at least dealing with affairs of state while the country is still in a bit of flux in its politics. So you'll have him, as he has been this week, talking out about all sorts of things, whether it's Israel's position vis-a-vis the Iran nuclear deal or trying to ascertain where the Biden administration stands on a whole host of things. Another development I forgot to mention was the Biden administration restoring funding for certain Palestinian initiatives that had been suspended under the Trump administration. I think it'll be a sense of Netanyahu trying to conduct business as usual, but there's no denying it could be a bit fraught because of the unsettled political nature in Israel.
Well, what do you make of the unsettled political element in neighboring Jordan? You mentioned charges of sedition by the former crown prince. There's been talk that the former crown prince of Jordan was getting support from an unnamed other country or countries. Do we have a good sense of what's actually transpiring at the upper echelons of the Jordanian government?
I don't think so. I have been trying to figure out and reading through the reports from the area, and it's worth noting that Georgian media is under a bit of a muzzle because of the very delicate nature of these developments. So people are we're trying to sort of read the developments through the prism of maybe other regional journalism, Israeli sources, and so forth. I do think that the defense secretary going there, it's going to be important for him to kind of pick up some intel on the ground, as it were, about how these events have transpired, who are the sources of a sort of outside influence in Jordan, what the Israelis know about it, what their views are on it. It was the readout from the call from President Biden to the Jordanian king was full of sort of reaffirmations about the U.S. support for, you know, the two-state solution in the Middle East, U.S. support for Jordan's role in sort of regional security. And related to the Iraq talks I mentioned, U.S. interest in Jordan having a bigger role in securing sort of its neighborhood as the U.S. tries to loosen its footprint in Iraq. So as I say, I think it's the timing of this is becoming more and more interesting and potentially vital because of all these things in flux right now. And the Jordan one is a real head scratcher.
Well, it certainly is. In reading a lot of the news reports, it's clear that King Abdullah does face some broader discontent among the Jordanian population, but also among the Jordanian elite. Lots of accusation of corruption that is out of control that is combined with a society that's been hard hit by COVID, where the economic performance has not been good. And obviously, Jordan, given its location, has been critically important in the region for the United States, certainly for the Israelis. And so any tumult or upheaval there could have much broader consequences in the region.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And again, it's the unusual nature of this. I mean, we are accustomed to all sorts of tumult and upheaval across the Middle East. Jordan is one of the few places where we don't see that. And we do tend to rely on and almost take for granted the stability of Jordan under King Abdullah, who's now been in that post more than 20 years, I believe. And yet, when that gets challenged, it creates real uncertainty and real unease because of Jordan's crucial position. It's, you know, just where it is and its role in trying to forge some sort of an agreement that will allow for a longer lasting peace between Arabs and Israelis is not to be diminished. So again, these are the types of things that Defense Secretary Austin will be following closely. It's worth noting that as General Austin, he headed up CENTCOM and is familiar with a lot of the actors and top officials in the region. So I think it's an important time for him to be going there in person and sort of hearing out where things stand on a lot of fronts.
Well, as you mentioned, one topic on the Netanyahu-Austin agenda is certainly going to be Iran. You mentioned that an Iranian tank was damaged by what has been reported to have been a limpet mine placed by the Israelis. These are mines that are attached magnetically to a ship's hull. And obviously, that brings the whole question of Iran's behavior in the region, but also Iran's nuclear program. And again, we'll talk about the negotiations in Vienna in a moment. But what message do you think Netanyahu is going to be giving Secretary Austin on the broader issue of relations with Iran?
Well, Jim, as Netanyahu has frequently reminded the U.S., and certainly before the Trump administration came into power, and now it's doing again, Israel is firmly against aspects of the JCPOA that it sees as opening up a path to developing nuclear weapons for Iran. And Netanyahu, that you may recall, has made repeated visits to the United Nations General Assembly, where he held up charts and images of Iran's weapons development. Israel has tried in many different ways to undermine that. He said just yesterday that Israel will not be bound by any agreement that allows Iran to develop nuclear weapons or a path to develop, which is basically an Israeli interpretation of a JCPOA that, say, freezes but does not eliminate a nuclear program in Iran. So I think it's safe to say you're going to hear a lot more sort of reiteration of that set of views. When the Obama administration had concluded, which was only a year after the JCPOA was reached, relations were a bit frosty between the Netanyahu government and the Obama administration. And so it's going to be a bit of testing of the waters of that and you know, hearing from the U.S. side that it is determined to revive this deal and that the U.S. remains firmly committed to Israel's security and will not allow anything to get in that way. So it's this delicate walk to bring the U.S. back to a deal that the Biden administration sees as very important for regional security at a time when one of its chief allies is dead set against it.
Well, let's talk about the JCPOA, Bob. In the next week, so-called expert-level talks are set to take place in Vienna on reviving the 2015 deal. Now, at the insistence of the Iranians, the talks are not going to involve face-to-face meetings between U.S. and Iranian diplomats. Instead, as I understand it, the two sides are going to work through intermediaries. What are the expectations we should have for the outcome of these negotiations, Bob?
As most of those who watch this process closely say, we should limit our expectations, but not foreclose on the idea that there could be some sort of agreement. There are all sorts of mitigating factors and all sorts of pressures going on, as we just alluded to. Certainly, Israel is dead set against this. Both publics in both Iran and the United States, there is very split opinion on the deal. In the U.S., the Biden administration faces very strong opposition from Republican lawmakers to go back to this deal. And Iranian hardliners also are not in favor of the deal, and for very different reasons. But it comes back to something that is a major barrier right now, which is a utter lack of trust in the other side. So the fact that the talks that kicked off a few days ago and are going to resume tomorrow, Jim, the fact that they're happening, the fact that the sides are saying positive things about the willingness of the other side to talk is taken as this great step forward, because there have been such acrimonious exchanges of language between Iran and the United States for the past several years. The agreement to set up working groups to look at the issue of, okay, which economic sanctions should be lifted, what Iranian steps to scale back its nuclear program should be followed first. The fact that there's working groups discussing those things is seen as an important step. And you've even heard the Rouhani government in Iran saying positive things about the way this has been kicked off. It's also worth noting that many of the representatives of the Biden administration who are taking part in this process, although not directly talking to Iranians, were part of the original negotiations that led up to the JCPOA in 2015. So you have a lot of actors who are well known, who certainly know very well the red lines of the Iranians, but also the parameters of the deal and what they're trying to get back to, you know, are going to try to reconstruct that. At the same time, what's, I think, especially interesting and also really daunting in these talks, Jim, is that both sides are talking about bigger things in the JCPOA. I think it was initially thought that, okay, let's restart and get back to where we were. But you're hearing from the Iranians, no, we want all sanctions that the U.S. is imposing on Iran lifted. And you're hearing from the U.S. side, well, we have to think about other ways in which Iran needs to rein in its behavior, not just on the nuclear front. So the degree to which those aspects can be brought into such a deal will be very intriguing and also, as I say, really daunting to sort of consider.
Well, I'll note, Bob, on that last point that the Biden administration has clearly signaled all along that its objective in all of these conversations isn't just to get back to the 2015 deal.
That's right.
It is
to
craft a longer, stronger, broader deal. And that's great to put down as a marker, but all the signs coming out of Tehran are that they agreed to the 2015 deal. That was as far as they're willing to go. And they're not interested at all in anything that is longer, stronger, or broader. So it's going to be very interesting to see if there is any way to overcome that fundamental difference. Because again, from the Iranian point of view, they can argue, we signed up to the deal, we were willing to abide by it, the United States left it, and essentially time is on our side because the provisions of the deal are going to expire, some of them as early as, I think, 2022, which I believe is next year, and I think all of them by the time you get to 2030. So there's a fundamental gap there, and I'm not sure how you close that gap or square the circle, depending upon the metaphor you want to use.
Jim, you mentioned timing. That the other interesting thing is the looming Iranian presidential elections in June, in which there is mounting speculation that a more hardline individual than Mr. Rouhani will emerge as the president of Iran, perhaps reflecting more of the views of the supreme leader, Ayatollah Ali Khamenei. And what that means for Iran's willingness to negotiate, sit down in any capacity vis-a-vis the U.S. is going to be very interesting. It also should be noted that Iran, as we discussed previously in the podcast, Iran has agreed to a very large deal with the Chinese for investment, multi-billion-dollar investment deal. We'll see how that plays out, but it just adds some potential leverage for Iran, which had been eager to get sanctions lifted, to bring back its economy, to bring back its capabilities. And a Chinese deal that brings an investment in crucial infrastructure investment potentially changes the calculation here. China, we should also note, is part of these negotiations as part of the P5+1 formula for the Iran nuclear deal talks. So another element that adds to what some see as added leverage for Iran.
Just a quick note on the Iranian elections. The obvious big question mark is if those elections do lead to a more hardline formal government, successor to Rouhani, whether the Iranian negotiating position will become even more hardline or whether such a government would have the political wherewithal to be able to deal. And that's, again, the big question mark. I don't think anybody knows, and you won't really discover it until it gets tested.
Well, Jim, there's another set of elections we're keen to talk about, and they're happening just in the next couple of days. On Sunday, Peruvians are going to vote in a general election for a new president and Congress. And this is happening, as with many countries, amid a backdrop of struggling with COVID-19. In fact, South America is dealing with especially virulent strain emanating from Brazil that has raised a great deal of concern and has sort of intensified a race to get vaccines. In the past few months, Peruvian politics have been tumultuous, to say the least. So, Jim, could you give us a sense of the backdrop leading up to these these votes?
Happy to, Bob. And I think tumultuous is exactly the right word to describe Peru's politics recently. You may remember last November, the Peruvian Congress convicted and ousted then-President Martín Vizcarra in an impeachment trial on bribery charges. That was actually the second impeachment trial of Vizcarra in just 2 months. And there's an irony here because Vizcarra, who doesn't belong to any of the political parties in the Peruvian Congress, had made anti-corruption a focal point of his presidential agenda. And now comes the twist. Many Peruvians believed, for very good reason, that the charges against Vizcarra were trumped up. And there were mass protests after he was removed from office that forced his successor, the former head of the Peruvian Congress, to resign after just 6 days. And then the Peruvian Congress settled on a centrist as an interim president to serve until the new president is installed. Now, the Sunday elections, April 11th elections, have been on the books for quite a while. And as you note, they are general elections, Bob. Peruvians are going to vote for a new president, two vice presidents, and their Congress. And Peru, like in many countries, has a system in which if no candidate gets a majority of the votes, there'll be a runoff. And the runoff in the case of Peru would happen on June 6th. And everybody is betting that we're going to get a runoff. Just to put it in perspective, there are 18 candidates on the ballot, and none of them right now commands a substantial lead in the public opinion polls. Indeed, many of them seem to be neck and neck. They're all hovering around 10% in the upper tier. Among the candidates are Keiko Fujimori. If that name sounds familiar, she is the daughter of former President Alberto Fujimori, who is now in Peruvian jail for a slew of crimes. And she actually ran back in 2016 and narrowly lost the election then. Another candidate is Hernando de Soto. This is not the Spanish conquistador who led the first European expedition to the lower Mississippi, but an economist who wrote a very well-regarded book called The Mystery of Capital. Now, as you alluded, Bob, one of the big issues in the vote is going to be COVID-19. Peru has the highest per capita death toll in Latin America and the sixth highest in the world. It's just behind the United States. Making matters worse, as you noted, Peru, like many Latin American countries, has been hit by new variants. Cases are currently surging. Three of the presidential candidates have been diagnosed in recent weeks with COVID. But COVID's not the only issue. The issue also has to do with the economy. Peru's GDP fell by 12% last year. There are big issues with crime, security, jobs, education, and corruption, as we've already discussed. So it's going to be a tumultuous election. And the question is going to be, what choices do Peruvians make? Now, Peruvians are required by law to vote, but I think it's safe to say if you look at public opinion polls, Peruvians are not really sold on democracy and its ability to address their particular problems. And I think that is a long-term problem for the Peruvians. And there is a question, if you can't return a Congress and a president that have sufficient political support to make big decisions, Peru's current situation of great difficulty could continue for quite some time.
Jim, we tend to talk about Latin American politics, at least recently, in terms of waves. You know, is there a Bolivarian sort of leftist wave taking foot? Is there a right-wing populist wave, you know, such as in Brazil emerging? You know, are we seeing any sort of tendency of these waves, or maybe could we get a more centrist, technocratic candidate emerging from Peru, Jim?
From what I can tell of Peruvian politics, what really stands out among everything is the degree of polarization. Again, if you're looking at the public opinion polls, there are six candidates polling right around 10%. That tells you that there is no consensus among Peruvians as to the way forward for the country. And that makes it a difficult solution to solve because obviously if 10% of the country is on the far left and 10% is on the far right and 10% is sort of right of center, 10% left of center, it becomes very hard to build a governing coalition. Now, typically in those situations, you talk about trying to form grand coalitions or having centrist parties come together. But obviously, there are issues that divide those parties. And so I think people are going to be looking at the results of this Sunday's election to see who are the two candidates left standing and who are they able to build support with. And that is, how do the political parties realign? And I think it's impossible to predict ahead of time how that's going to work out. But obviously, how it does work out is going to have big long-term consequences.
Well, Jim, we've talked ourselves into the audience figure of the week portion of the podcast. And this week we had something unusual happen. We had a photo finish from our audience. They selected two figures of the week with the identical percent of the vote, almost a third of the vote for each of those. And those two figures are minimum global corporate tax and Navalny's health declines. Jim, let's pick up with the Russian figure first. Talk to us a bit about why the Navalny situation is significant.
Well, Bob, we've talked about Alexei Navalny before on the podcast. He is the Putin critic and opposition leader who was poisoned in Siberia last summer. He recovered over the fall in a Berlin hospital. Then he returned to Moscow this past January, only to be sentenced to 2.5 years in prison for supposedly violating the terms of his parole on an earlier conviction. Russian authorities sent him to Penal Colony Number 2, which is about 60 miles east of Moscow. Now, Penal Colony Number 2 is said to be a harsh prison, even by Russian standards. And by all accounts, Navalny has faced pretty tough conditions since being sent to the prison. He went on a hunger strike last week to demand proper treatment for acute back and leg pain. And there's debate about what the source of the pain is. There's been some speculation it may be a lingering effect of the poisoning. But there are also reports that he has two spinal hernias. Anyone who's had a herniated disc knows how excruciating that can be. On top of all of this, there are now reports that Navalny has been suffering a respiratory illness. There's been speculation that it might be COVID. Also speculation it might be tuberculosis. And tuberculosis has been a very big problem in Russian prisons. Now, while Navalny is on this hunger strike trying to draw attention to his plight, his allies have been using his Instagram account to post information. And among other things, it is reported that prison authorities have been trying to torment Navalny by roasting chicken near him and placing sweets in the pockets of his clothes. Common reaction in the West has been to condemn the treatment of Navalny and ask for his release or at least better medical care. I'll note that the Biden administration this week said that his imprisonment was politically motivated in a gross injustice, but there's no sign indicating that that's likely to move the needle with Putin and the Russian authorities.
Yeah, Jim, I would just say it does seem like we're seeing a devolution that is some way similar to what happened to Sergei Magnitsky, the anti-corruption lawyer who was imprisoned, beaten, and allowed to die from various ailments and became a cause celeb that actually led to the U.S. setting up very strict sanctions regarding human rights abuses and tagging them to individuals. Navalny, obviously, much more ambitious and much more appealing towards a broad swath of Russians and in terms of opposing Putin than Magnitsky ever was. However, there does, again, seem to be from someone who's followed these things over the years that there's a pattern in the Russian behavior. And that was all, I think, to be expected, frankly. I'm not looking at this as ending in anything else than just the continuing deterioration in his condition, unfortunately. You have Russia posing all sorts of challenges that transcend Navalny. The latest one I would just point to is a buildup on its border with Ukraine and concerns that it might be readying to boost as the separatist forces fighting against the Ukrainian government. That in and of itself requires some sort of potent Western response, U.S. and European allies. So this Navalny case, I think we'll be tracking it, but it's looking pretty grim.
Certainly is. And I think for people who have been arguing that the United States needs to find a way to split Russia from its alignment with China are going to have an even harder road to cover, just given what the Russians are doing in Ukraine, as you note, and their treatment of Navalny.
Well, Jim, the other audience figure select is of a different sort. This is the figure minimum global corporate tax, which became quite a bit of discussion this week, occurring at the same time as the spring meetings of the World Bank and IMF. Could you talk a bit about what that figure is all about?
Bob, I have to say it's an appropriate topic because we're in the middle of tax season. I just paid my federal and state taxes.
Oh, congratulations.
Just this week. So I'm in the whole tax mode right now. As you note, Secretary Yellen gave her speech on Monday to the Chicago Council on Global Affairs. The immediate reason for Yellen's call for a global corporate tax rate is that President Biden is proposing to raise U.S. corporate taxes from 21% to 28% as part of his proposed $2.5 trillion infrastructure bill. Now, let me be very careful here and quick to point out that when we talk about these numbers like 21% or 25% or 28%, these are the nominal tax rates. They're not the effective tax rates. Effective tax rates take into account the nominal tax rate and then the deductions and exemptions you get under the tax code, which is enormously complex. And as it turns out, if you look across U.S. corporations, the level of their effective tax rate varies widely. The reason Yellen is talking about this is that they're concerned that as the United States raises its corporate tax rate, that it could have perverse consequences. It could make U.S. companies less profitable compared to global competitors. It could potentially lead some American firms to relocate overseas. And it would also encourage companies to pursue strategies that book more profits overseas in lower tax countries so they don't have to pay taxes here at home. These problems can be diminished to a considerable degree if countries agree on a reasonably high minimum tax rate for corporations. That would prevent you from getting a so-called race to the bottom, where countries use offers of lower taxes to entice companies to locate there. I should point out there have been ongoing negotiations on these issues under the auspices of the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. Now, the OECD has 37 members, think essentially the wealthiest countries in the world, but 139 countries have been participating in these negotiations. And the negotiations have been over two sets of issues. One is agreeing on this global minimum corporate tax, and the other is over the question of which country has the right to tax which corporate profits. And this has a lot to do with the proliferation of taxes on digital companies. A lot of foreign countries are concerned that companies like Facebook and Google make a lot of money in their country, but actually employ very few people. The United States doesn't want taxes focused particularly on digital companies, because that's where the United States has a lead. They want to have taxes that cover all industry. Now, it's pretty easy to see why it's in the collective interest of states to come to agreement on these topics. You have less fear that you're going to be undercut by another country. It's also easy to see how devastatingly difficult it is to forge agreement, because there are legitimate differences over what countries see as their income to tax. So important set of negotiations, not clear if we're going to get an agreement. If we do, big consequences. If we don't, big consequences.
And again, because it's a U.S. Treasury Secretary saying these things, some are attaching more importance to it. You mentioned it's an OECD initiative, or the OECD has been heavily involved. Do we get a sense whether, Jim, this builds any momentum coming out of the IMF meetings or running up to the G7 summit and forums like that?
I wouldn't link it to events at the spring meetings of the IMF and the World Bank. I think the significance here is that you now have the Biden administration in office. It is going to be putting its plans on the negotiating table. So that's what is likely to spur conversation. You're going to have, obviously, the world's largest economy having a particular proposal, giving diplomats something to negotiate over. Of course, the fact that there is something to talk about and negotiate doesn't mean you get the conclusion or get a conclusion anytime soon. And again, this is an incredibly complicated issue that has all kinds of intended and unintended consequences, which is why everyone is putting a lot of time and thought into it, precisely because it could come back both to reward them or to haunt them.
And that's our look at the complex world next week. Here are some other stories to keep an eye on. Greece's foreign minister is set to visit Turkey, and the Muslim holy month of Ramadan begins.
Please subscribe to The World Next Week on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts, and leave us a review while you're at it. They help us get noticed and improve the show. Please note that opinions expressed in The World Next Week are solely those of the host or our guests, not of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's program was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Shirley. Zoe also did double duty as a recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks go out to Anna Shortridge and Bethany Wright for their assistance. Our theme music is provided by Miguel Herrero and licensed under Creative Commons. This is Jim Lindsay saying goodbye.
And this is Bob McMahon saying so long and stay healthy out there.